Peter B. Collins.
How you doing out there?
News and comment. Doing fine.
You ever seem to have one of those days where it just seems like...
It's Friday, August 12th, 2016.
Best girlfriend.
Are we really going to fight about access to bathrooms?
But I found a way to get out of it. Let me tell you about it. Smoking in the bar.
Access to the boys' room by a transgender individual. In this case, it would be a biological female who identifies as male and wants to use the boys' bathroom. And this has produced a flood of lawsuits from attorneys general in conservative states and from a feminist group. And I am puzzled by this. Because I really don't think there is a big issue. I think that people have some creepy feelings, and there is very little evidence to support the notion that a transgender individual would go into the bathroom of the other sex for kicks, to get their jollies. And so I find this baffling. I really do. President Obama tried to put this to rest back in May by issuing a clarification of Title IX, which is described as an unconstitutional policy that has been articulated by the federal government in the lawsuits challenging it. And the lawsuits come from deep red states, Texas, Bama, Wisconsin, West Virginia, Tennessee, Arizona, Maine, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Utah, Georgia, Mississippi, and Kentucky. And they say that this is going to create even more problems. And they even put it in terms of danger to individuals. Here's the Senate president in North Carolina, where they passed the bathroom bill, HB 2. He said, "We have a bill that makes it clear we're not going to put our citizens in further danger." Now, what dangerous episodes have occurred in bathrooms as a result of transgender persons? I'm not aware of any. I think the conflicts are in the minds of some people who have hang-ups. And this guy Berger went on to say that it is, quote, dangerous to allow anyone who is biologically male into a girl's bathroom. Now, can we get real about this just for a minute and let me use just plain language? If you are a female and a person who has a penis, biologically male, enters the restroom and goes into the stall and urinates or defecates next to you, how has that made danger for you? How has that violated your right to privacy? I simply don't understand it. And the idea that someone who identifies as the gender other than their biological assignment wants to go into a bathroom for some sort of weird sexual kinky activities? Again, I've seen no evidence of this. And certainly it might have occurred in some isolated instance. But this is a solution in search of a problem. And I want to acknowledge that the Women's Liberation Front has filed a separate lawsuit in New Mexico challenging this government policy. And they raise some interesting issues here. But again, I find this hysterical and that it tries to fix a problem that can be handled on a case-by-case interpersonal basis. The women's group called WOLF, Women's Liberation Front, argues that the Obama policy will result in the eradication of female-only spaces in educational institutions. It puts biological female students at an unfair disadvantage in athletics and threatens the safety and privacy of women and girls. It also contends there's no scientific support for the concept that gender identity is equivalent to biological sex. And that may be a fair point. But I don't think it's germane to dealing with these issues again, on a case-by-case basis. And there are ways to have unisex bathrooms, separate showers. There are all kinds of accommodations that can be made. And the idea that we need to harden policy in order to protect people from some dangerous threat here, I think is just really far-fetched. So two members of Wolf, a high school and college student, are concerned that the policy will force them to share sensitive private spaces, such as bathrooms, locker rooms, and changing rooms, with biological males, and that this is a violation of their constitutionally guaranteed rights to privacy. Well, how much space do you need? How much privacy do you need? There are many ways, even if you're standing in a locker room, to change your clothes without revealing your private parts. And the more people who are in a restroom or a locker room, that provides a kind of social a social balance where nothing, you know, improper is going to occur because there's so many people there who would observe it. Here's a quote from the lawsuit. This policy undermines safety and bodily privacy for females by unconstitutionally eliminating Title IX protections. If anyone can use any bathroom based solely on the concept of self-declared gender identity, that means that any male can access a women's or girls' room at any time, be in the presence of naked women and girls, and expose his body to women and girls. This is an outrageous assault on women's privacy. It is? I mean, let's put this in context. People who have a gender identification issue, I think it's called gender dysphoria, in most cases are not aggressive people. They are not predatory. They are not seeking to convert others. They're working through an internal struggle. And this type of rejection leads to bullying and other problematic behaviors, in my opinion. Now, reading again from the news release from the feminist group Wolf, they support protecting students who identify as transgender from abuse or discrimination, but this policy mistakenly purports to do so by ignoring how women and girls are especially susceptible to discrimination and abuse on the basis of their biological sex, and threatens all legal protections designed to prevent and reverse sex-based discrimination. Now, another point raised in this lawsuit that I think is legitimate is that we have mashed up the definitions of sex and gender. Gender is a term that is used explicitly related to language. The pronoun he is of the male gender. But my gender is only male in terms of language and syntax. My sex is male. That's how I was born, and that's how I identify. Now, I realize that there's some gray areas here, and there are some possibilities where people might encounter some uncomfortable situations. But to call uncomfortable situations dangerous, and that they threaten all legal protections, I think is just very extreme. And I believe that these people deserve their day in court and they should be able to air these issues out. I do think that the way the Obama administration tried to handle it is not legally effective. But I am still baffled that we are struggling over these issues in any significant way. Hillary Clinton and her running mate Tim Kaine have released their tax returns from 2015. And Tim Kaine, with his wife, reported an income of $313,000. Bill and Hillary Clinton had an adjusted gross income of $10.6 million. It is their lowest level of income, I think, in the last 10 years or so. Now, first of all, I want to be fair to the Clintons. They have made a boatload of money, $150 million, since 2007. They are very wealthy people now. And it wasn't always that way. They struggled in Arkansas. Yes, they were broke because of the costs of legal fees for impeachment and Lewinsky when they left the White House. And they have been fully transparent. I've reviewed the Clintons' tax returns in some detail. So I give them credit for transparency. What I find amazing is that the Clintons, who, by the way, have paid $48 million in federal taxes since 2007, and they've given $16 million of their wealth to charity. I don't believe that's the Clinton Foundation either. I think those are separate contributions to outside charities. Donald Trump has barely given much cash away. He has put some money into his own foundation, but mostly used it to collect from others. And he usually gives away free golf outings at his resorts and not any major cash contributions. But what I find amazing is how Hillary Clinton identifies related to her wealth, even if it did come relatively late in life. Because as she hammered Donald Trump's economic plan and presented her own in Detroit yesterday, she referred to the wealthy as if they are other people. And she is a one percenter. And I give Obama credit. He made a lot of money on his books and has had million-dollar incomes at different times over the last 10 years or so. And he will acknowledge that he is among high-income individuals. But not Hillary Clinton. And so she outlined an economic plan that's certainly better than Trump's. But in showing just how she has massaged the agreements that she made with Bernie Sanders and the plays that she made for his progressive voters, she has come out in favor of a $12 national minimum wage. Not 15. Not aspiring to 15, not 15 in high cost of living places or, any kind of adjustments like that. She's talking a maximum of $12 an hour. She calls for an infrastructure plan that would be paid for by an infrastructure bank. We don't know whose money goes into the infrastructure bank, but previous proposals have been to declare a tax holiday for companies like Apple that have stashed billions offshore to avoid American taxes, and that we would repatriate that money at a very low tax rate that might go into an infrastructure bank. She also talks about trying to renegotiate, refinance student loans. So all of this is a pile of incrementalism. And it moves in the right direction. I don't have a big objection to that. But she's not honoring the Democratic platform or the progressive proposals that were put out by Bernie Sanders over the past year. And when she cites the Buffett rule is when she talks about other people who are wealthy and that, you know, he shouldn't pay a lower tax rate than his secretary, right? So I just find that really interesting. And in an analysis of her economic speech, Colin Holtz in The Guardian notes a couple of other points. She did come out in strong opposition to the TPP, and I disagree with Colin Holtz here because he says that she studiously avoided opposing a vote in the December lame duck session. I heard her explicitly say she is against the TPP now. She will be against it after the election. That's November. And she said she will be against it as president. And I'm going to hold her to this because this was a hard-fought issue in the Democratic primary this year, and she flipped. And during the convention, her pal Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, flatly told reporters, he had to take it back later, that she would flip again after the November elections and support President Obama's effort to ram it through. Also, Holtz notes that Hillary Clinton did not embrace a 21st century Glass-Steagall Act to separate the casino arms of the banks from the depositor side of the banks. And it's funny because such a proposal is included in the Republican platform. We don't know how it got there, but it's there. And she also didn't address too big to fail banks or any of those related issues, which were centerpieces of the Sanders campaign. And I want to credit the New York Times front page on Friday's paper. The headline reads, "The millions of Americans Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton barely mention the poor." And one of the central issues, even though we haven't had huge price inflation, certainly the low cost of oil and energy products has been helpful to our economy and kept inflation down. But in the Bay Area, and perhaps where you live, the cost of rental housing has shot up dramatically. And it is really squeezing working families. And I don't hear anybody talking about that on the national level. And the Times is correct to point out that this has not been a part of the debate, and Bernie Sanders didn't bring it up either. Oh, and by the way, I wanted to mention, just to be fair, when I was talking about the tax returns, Trump refuses, Clinton and Kaine have put them out, I want to note that Bernie Sanders did not honor his pledge to release all of his tax returns. He selectively released one and then dragged his feet and never fully addressed why he wouldn't release more. And there are important questions about Jane Sanders and the money she collected from that university that went belly up in Burlington. And so I just want to be fair that there are many people who kept asking for Bernie's tax returns, and I was among them, and we never did get to see them. Every day I pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your voluntary contributions by means of a subscription. People like Julie Dupree, Kevin Kallstein just renewed his annual subscription. Thanks, Kevin. Andy Krieger and DGL. They're all long-term subscribers to this program, and I encourage you to support us as well. So come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the button that says menu, then the pull-down, become a subscriber. And that takes you to the sign-up page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or our $50 annual subscription and the bonus books for new annual subscribers with a continental address, a continental mailing address here in the U.S. You will get a bonus book. There are two of them available on the sign-up page. Well, before Congress took its long summer vacation, they failed to approve funding for investigation into a Zika virus and the necessary public health programs that will be needed to address the growing threat of the Zika virus. There are now 7,350 cases in the United States, mostly in Puerto Rico. But the Obama administration is basically pulling pennies out of the couch. And they scraped up $81 million that is being diverted from biomedical research and anti-poverty and healthcare programs to pay for the research and development of a Zika vaccine. And this is a really stunning example of the intentional failures of Republicans in our legislative branch, because they killed the bill that would have provided partial funding for this right before the recess by insisting that Planned Parenthood be blocked from giving out condoms to prevent the sexual transmission of the Zika virus, for example. And so by putting in the poison pill related to Planned Parenthood, the Republicans cynically tried to force the Democrats to accept a bill that would hammer Planned Parenthood. And the Democrats correctly refused. But to play politics with this, and it also creates the impression. I remember talking to my brother-in-law, Mike, in Michigan, who said, well, gosh, didn't the Democrats block that Zika thing? And this is part of the misleading depiction that many Americans have of what goes on in Washington. They think that the obstructionists are the Democrats. Why? Because the Republicans and Fox News repeatedly tell them that. For many years, I've railed against the development of private prisons run by corporations in this country. And there are 14 at the federal level. Almost all of them house immigration detainees. And they don't get constitutional rights. They don't have even the fundamental right to avoid cruel and unusual punishment. And so at these prisons, according to a new report by the Inspector General, the situations are drastically more unsafe and more punitive. For example, at these private prisons, the inmates were 9 times more likely to be placed on lockdown than prisoners at other federal prisons. They are frequently subjected to arbitrary, solitary confinement. In 2 of the prisons that the investigators routinely visited, new inmates were automatically placed in solitary because of overcrowding. So there are also serious problems with medical care, the treatment by staff, and obviously the quality of the food. So inmate-on-inmate assaults are 28% higher in contract prisons, and the confiscation of contraband mobile phones is 8 times higher. And so there are very real problems here. And we lock people up and we look the other way and let them languish there for months, sometimes years. And it's very un-American, it's unconstitutional, but I'm afraid nothing's going to be done about it. Yesterday, I expressed some skepticism about the rosy accounts coming from the Pentagon about the way the United States and others have decimated the Islamic State fighters. They claim 45,000 have been vanquished. They don't say how many of those are killed, how many of those just have evaporated. But the U.S. Central Command is being hammered by both Republicans and Democrats from the House Armed Services Committee, the Intelligence Committee, and the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. They're saying that the product, the data product, the analysis, the statistics coming out of CENTCOM is unacceptable, and that the accusation is that senior leaders have manipulated the intelligence products to downplay the threat from the Islamic State in Iraq. And these complaints are coming from Republican Mike Pompeo of Kansas and Democrat Adam Schiff of California, who said that, between 2014 and 15, CENTCOM created an overly insular process for producing intelligence assessments, and he says that they have insufficiently accommodated dissenting views. So I think we should be skeptical of what the Pentagon has been trying to tell us. Now, I don't pretend to know exactly what's going on in Ukraine and Crimea, but the New York Times airs out some of the recent events and some speculation in a piece in Friday's paper. And they say there are two sets of overlapping events, both shrouded in mystery. Last Saturday, Russian intelligence officers discovered a group of saboteurs on the Crimean side of their border with Ukraine. A fight ended up with one of the Russian officers killed, and several of the alleged saboteurs were captured. And Moscow insists that the Ukraine sponsored the plot, but Kiev says, oh no, those are just local people who are doing that on their own. So whatever happened, images found by open-source analysts suggest that Russia has been escalating its military presence in Crimea since at least Saturday. There are convoys with heavy weapons moving around the peninsula. So the speculation is that there may be a skirmish between Ukraine and Russia in the coming days, and Petro Poroshenko, the candyman who runs the government in Kiev with the backing of the U.S., has been putting on a uniform and posing for pictures with armaments. But the speculation is that Putin might be maneuvering for some sort of a grand bargain to try to get Russia to broker an end to the war in Syria in exchange for international recognition of its annexation of Crimea. And speaking of Ukraine, a Ukrainian website has published what it says is an email archive with copies of IDs and personal data of Ukrainian and international journalists. Now, I have personal interest in this, as I'll explain in a moment. The archive, posted by Myro Tvorets, comes from a disenchanted rebel official. Thousands of emails published late Wednesday contains photographs and copies of journalist travel IDs. And in May, this same outlet leaked names and contact information for thousands of reporters who have reported from rebel-controlled eastern Ukraine. Now, this has drawn sharp criticism of this move from Western journalist groups. And in the leaked documents, reporters for the Associated Press, the New York Times, BBC, Vice, and many other media organizations are included. Now, I haven't checked to see if I'm on that list, but I want to note that my webmaster, John Gorenfeld, has reported that recently there have been repeated attempts to hack into the servers where we host peterbcollins.com, and he says that they appear to originate from Ukraine. So I don't know why I am being honored in this manner, but I also want to thank our listener and subscriber, George Mashke, who lives in the Netherlands, who suggested to me a couple of months ago that we harden our website. And we did so. I won't go into detail, but we did a little of this and we did a little of that and changed some passwords. And so I'm doing better than the DNC so far. In Germany, as a result of the recent events, and with an eye on upcoming elections within the next year, government officials are proposing some pretty extreme moves. They want to hire more federal police officers. They want to make it a crime to simply express sympathy for terrorism or, I guess, terrorist groups. They want greater sharing of information, intelligence data across Europe, closer monitoring of the dark web, and stripping dual citizens of their German citizenship if they fight for extremist groups. They also want to make it easier to deport foreigners deemed to be dangerous. And this is a very serious threshold for Germany, because after World War II, the U.S. helped them write a new constitution that tried to prevent the rise of a police state, whether you look at the example of East Germany and the Stasi, or go back to Hitler's Germany. And I know, because I did some work in Berlin a few years back, that Germany doesn't have the First Amendment that we enjoy here. There are strict limits on public speech. And so for Germans, these measures might not seem draconian. But I think this is a tipping point where Germany really needs to exercise caution and not be drawn into these extreme measures because of the threat from right-wing groups at the next election. And finally today, we have collusion, or is it collaboration, between America's FBI and the vaunted Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And it developed into a skirmish in the province of Ontario yesterday that led to the death of 24-year-old Aaron Driver, who had been monitored by Canadian authorities. And the story is that the FBI tipped off the Canadian authorities that this guy Driver had made a martyrdom video in which he pledged allegiance to the Islamic State and made comments like, "We thirst for your blood." And so they alerted the Mounties, and as they started to surround a home where Driver was living with a sister, a cab arrived, and he got in the cab. The Mounties shot at the taxi cab, and in doing so, they may have detonated some explosives that Driver had on his person in the back of the taxi, because shots were fired and then it exploded. Now, it's possible that Driver detonated those himself, but that is an interesting development of this kind of cooperation between the U.S. and Canadians in these domestic terrorism cases, which, as you know, I view with a very skeptical eye. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. This is the free podcast that I hope you'll share far and wide. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.